All right, we're this morning ready to break into a new period. Here's where we've been. We took the Old Testament and broke it down in what we call the world history period. The reason for blocking this Genesis 1 through Genesis 11 off as a unique period of time is very simple. There were no chosen people. When we get to Abraham today, everything is going to be just like twisting it right into focus and coming down to one individual that will be the focal point, and the nation of Israel will be the focal point. We went through the event of creation, Genesis 1 and 2, the fall, 3 through 5, the flood, 6 through 9, and then Babel chapter 10 and 11. Also going through that period, divine institutions, God gave man a will, capacity to choose. You have the institution of marriage, the responsibility to keep the family intact. You have the institution of government, which is the responsibility to maintain law and order. So we came through the divine institutions, and now we're ready to come to the second period of Old Testament history, which is the patriarchs. And the focus, as you can see, instead of being on events, will now be on men, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And we're also able, for the first time, to come up with a reasonably good date. We can reasonably accurately date Abraham somewhere around 2166 B.C. If you want the technical information on how do you come up with biblical dates, I'll be glad to see you separately on that. Basically, what happens is the Bible is filled with dates and times, but they don't all relate to the same event. Consequently, it makes it difficult to date, even though there are many dates within the text of the Bible. This date is arrived from the fact that you can relate to the Assyrian eponym lists, which means they dated each year by a king and named it for a king. And that can be tied in also with the accuracy with which astronomy can date eclipses of the moon. And consequently, from that, you can come up with dates. That's a technical matter. If you're interested in it, I can point you to some sources for dealing with that. But we can come up with a birth date of the patriarch Abraham somewhere around 2166. We'll be looking today in our three studies at really all three of these individuals. It's a little bit difficult to take Isaac and deal with his life all by himself, simply because Isaac is more of a transition between Abraham and Jacob. You get the life of Abraham pretty solid. You get a lot about Jacob, and Isaac is interwoven with Abraham. And when you think of Isaac, what do you think of? Your mind inevitably goes to that event whereby Abraham, his father, was told to place him on the altar and offer Isaac. And of course, in Genesis 22, in that context, Isaac is all passive. It's only Isaac considered in relationship to his father Abraham. And the same thing will be true as we come into the like of Jacob. So this man is sort of a transition that ties Abraham and Jacob together and therefore is difficult to handle. As a matter of fact, I tried to handle Isaac separately, and I simply couldn't do it. He's too interwoven with the events of Abraham and the events of Jacob. However, we will consider him a little bit tonight in terms of how he does seem to portray in about nine aspects or so, which is on the back side of your sheet, as an illustration of Christ. And we'll note some points of comparison that are very interesting between the two, how he does foreshadow and illustrate some very definite things about Christ, and we'll look at him in that aspect. Also, if you'll notice at the last part of your notes, you've got something that appears to be completely unrelated. It says the concordance. What we want to begin to do, and I'm not going to do it as separate lessons, but as lessons attached to others, is talk about certain Bible tools. How do you use them? What is the concordance? Most of us sitting here have concordances in the back of our text, or Bible text, which are not complete, but have some content to them. And I think, by and large, probably if we've ever used a concordance, you used it for one thing. Let's see, what is that verse that I can't find that's got this word in it? And you go to a concordance and skim down the list. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. And you can't remember where that's found, so you go to mind, and trace through until you come to that word, or you come to the word peace, and you trace through until you come to it. If people who did the tedious work of making Bible concordances, and it was tedious work, very tedious work, If they knew that's all we use their concordance for, they would probably rise from the grave and smite us all. Because that was not the intent, and that is certainly not the purpose, though it's a spinoff. It's not the purpose, really, of a concordance. There are some other reasons for it. And so tonight we want to take probably 10, 15 minutes at the end of the study to go through and say, what is a concordance used for? How can you use it beneficially? We'll also come in on the end of some other lessons on a commentary. If we're using a library, you ought to know how to read one and how to call out what is good, how to critique one, and so forth. So we'll be putting that into the lessons also. But this morning we're ready now to start with the life of the patriarch Abraham, born somewhere around 2166 B.C. All right? Our objective, then, is to observe the promise that God made to Abraham, and that's really the key thing. God makes to this man a promise, and the key feature of the life of Abraham is to observe that promise and his response to it. So let's simply put down as an objective to observe the promise made by God to Abram, and we're putting Abraham down here. That comes along later. It's really Abram, to be accurate, to start out with. The promise made by God to Abram, and how did he respond to that particular promise? Now, we've stated that Abraham is a very, very significant and important Old Testament character, and he is important in the Old Testament for two reasons. Number one reason that Abraham is significant and important not only in the Old Testament but in the New is simply this. Number one, the New Testament writers refer to him more than any other character than Christ. And that's got to put Abram right up front as far as importance and significance in the mind of the biblical authors. No other man, Isaiah, Joseph, Jacob, Moses, no other character is referred to more than Abraham is in the New Testament. If you want your figures on it, you find Abraham referred to some 230 times in the Old Testament, and the New Testament authors referring to him about 75 times. And that's heavy. Here is an Old Testament character, one of the first ones we meet among God's chosen people, that the New Testament authors refer to some 75 times. The second thing that makes him very significant and very important is he is the supreme example of how to have a relationship to God. Now, we'll come off of that when we look at the New Testament use, but very simply stated, when we come into the patriarchal period of the Old Testament, when God is building the nation of Israel around these men, and we might put, incidentally, in the context of these four patriarchs, the word nation will not put Israel, because it's not until we come up to Jacob that we will have Jacob's name changed over to Israel. But the nation concept begins, before there was a nation, or before it was named. It gets named Israel up here with Jacob, but the nation concept gets started clear back with Abraham. And in this particular period of time, beginning with Abraham, God is going to say, look, the way Abraham related to me is the only way anybody for all time can have a relationship to me. That's got to be significant. In other words, if we do not come to God the Abraham way, we don't come to God at all. If we are not saved the way Abraham was, exactly the way Abraham was, we're not saved at all. And the emphasis is going to be very simple. God gave to this man a promise and said, you want to relate to me? Believe it. And that is going to proceed as a principle right straight throughout the rest of the Old Testament. It comes down into the church age, and this is true of all time, that God's means of blessing to man is to issue promises. Now, there is a distinction. We have about how many thousand, perhaps, more promises than Abraham did. And we also have them in writing. And consequently, I would think with that comes a great deal more responsibility. But nonetheless, this man is pivotal, because if we don't see his relationship to God, we're going to miss the whole essence of the way God deals with us. And that brings up, therefore, the four vital issues that enter into the life of Abraham. These are vital issues from the standpoint that they are just as relevant to us sitting here in the church age as they were to Abraham. And the first basic pivotal feature communicated to Abraham and also communicated to us is he had to deal with the promises made by God. Frankly, the promises related to Abraham revolved about two pivotal things. Number one, you're going to have a posterity. Or the word that's going to be used there is the word in Hebrew for seed. For those that are New American Standard Version, that will show up in the word descendants over and over again. You're going to have descendants like the sand of the sea and like the stars of the heaven. And therefore, the promises are going to revolve about seed and, number two, the land. The seed of Abraham is still dealing with the land, as you well know. So the promises are going to be very, very vital. Now, always in the way God deals is to give a promise, and then the nature of that promise is such that everything in environment says the promise is foolishness. It's nonsense. It's impossible. Consequently, Abraham lived under a great series of pressures. And it is the number two important point for Abraham, the presence of pressures. And that is simply the idea that he was surrounded with an environment that said the promises don't work. They're not effective. They are impossible to fulfill. And that's a vital feature in the life of Abraham. And we ought to be able to begin to identify with that. You look at the promises that God has made to us in His Word, and you have to admit that what we see by sight and what we see in terms of the promises and the pressures that surround us, we don't see how in the world those things are ever going to be fulfilled. We have been promised, for example, that we are going to be made like His Son. Now that is some big promise. You and me, if we're realistic about ourselves, are going to be like Christ. And that is a great promise. And yet, when you look at environment, you say, hey, we'll never make it. And Romans 8:28 is a beauty. All things work together. God is working all things together for our good. And that's a clear promise. And when you look at environment, you say, I can't see it at all how this is happening. And therefore, in that context, with the pressures of environment, the promises of the Word, we therefore are demanded, as was Abraham, to give a response. And the responses involved work this way. And again, we should be able to identify with this. We'll see it in the life of Abraham. Sometimes Abraham will respond in such a way that the promise goes way into the background and he drives himself crazy over the pressure. Identify? Abraham will do this repeatedly. The pressure will become so big, there will be his focal point, it will become so big and the impossibility of the fulfillment of the promise so vivid that he won't even see the promise. He'll walk along as though no promise had ever been made, and he will reflect all of the instability, the panic, and so forth will come to the forefront. When the pressure becomes prominent, that's his response, and the promise fades in the background. On the other hand, there will be times when Abraham sees nothing but the promise. And when he sees nothing but the promise, the pressures are there, but they become very insignificant, and they will result in a very stable type Abraham. And that, again, is something we ought to be able to identify with, because I'm sure throughout our week we have in front of us the promises, and we have followed a pattern of some sort whereby the pressures were so big, we focused on them and responded to them so positively that the promises, we almost forgot that there ever was a Romans 8:28. And when we're reminded of it, we say, oh, I'd forgotten because I've been so involved with the pressures. On the other hand, it could be that you've had a super week, had the opportunity under many pressures and tests to say, look, the environment says it doesn't work, but I've been sitting on the promise and the promise has been predominant. If so, then your tummy is probably less irritated than those that have had the pressures up front who have the heartburn and so forth. Then, fourth, to this, flowing out of it, you have a set of results. We are, by and large, the living story of how we respond to the promises. And our disposition, our temperament, and so forth is pretty much giving one story all the time. Are we putting the promises in the forefront, or are we putting the pressures in the forefront? And therefore, with Abraham, we might subdivide that a little bit in terms of the results are going to be objective. By objective, with Abraham, I mean God simply flat does something miraculous. That would be something like in the birth of Isaac. Impossibility of Sarah or Abraham having children, and God, he responds with faith to the word, and God objectively comes in and does what is impossible. So the objective is simply God doing the impossible, which in cases in the life of Abraham, he does. And in cases of believers today, there are occasions when God simply comes through with an objective, all-out-and-out miracle. It just couldn't happen, but God did it. The subjective result of his response would be his faith grows. Faith grows, stability grows, inner peace grows, tranquility grows, and so forth. Now this we'll find throughout the life of Abraham over and over and over and over. And what we'll do in a few moments is come back to the life of Abraham in terms of these four things. And I'm going to spell out three places where we'll have the promise, pressure, response, result, pattern. One in chapter 12, one in chapter 15. And then try to structure the study in such a way to say this, make an assignment. The next time you read through Genesis 12 through chapter 25, where verse 18, where you have pretty much a breaking point in the life of Abraham, when you do that, do it with a pencil and a blank piece of paper, and you put down promise, pressure, response, and result, and jot down verses 1 through 3. The emphasis is on the promise, and then notice here it comes in verse 4, the pressure. And then that's followed by Abraham's response. What was it? And what were the results he got in context? And try and leave it with you so that beyond the two examples we're going to give, you'll be able to build on it in terms of intelligent Bible study. All right, now let's take and break down Abraham's life into, first of all, his life at Ur. Life of Abraham at Ur. We'll look at his life at Ur, his life in Haran, how God made the covenant with him there, but first of all, his life back in Ur. The first thing we can say about Abraham and his life in Ur is, number one, he was born in Ur of the Chaldees. He was born here. And for that, let's go to the text, Genesis chapter 11, verse 27. As a matter of fact, next to life at Ur, it is Genesis 11, 27 through the end of the chapter, which is verse 32. In other words, we're looking at Genesis 11, 27 through 32 as our passage. Verse 27. Now these are the records, or this is the history of Terah. That's Abraham's father. Terah became the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. And therefore you've got Abraham born in this particular place. From that we can say several things. In the first place, this city in which he was born, and I don't know what when we say Ur of Chaldees, what your mind goes to. It may go to tents and Bedouins and sand and people with shepherd's crooks and sandals and no culture, no refinement. You may think back, and we tend to do that, to think that we're at the very apex of culture and civilization and think back at those poor, unrefined, uncivilized people. And we may be thinking that Abraham is so far back there that he barely knew enough to put on clothes. So let's eliminate that. Ur is one of the most excavated cities from the standpoint of archaeology in the world around the late 19th century, well, mid-19th century. You had excavation there, and the things that were found were cemeteries. They buried people in Ur. A lot of jewelry. That always points to refinement. Tumblers for banquets, golden ones, were found in Ur. And some excellent, if you see them ever pictured, excellent artworks. Now, a primitive civilization, as you probably would guess, does not engage in artwork of any degree. And you don't have the jewelry and the facilities such as the golden tumblers for banquets and serving. So we're not talking about a primitive civilization. We're talking about a city in which he lived that reached a high degree of civilization. The other thing that is known from archaeology about it is that it was a center for the worship of the moon. It's a center for moon worship. And from archaeology, we know that Nannar, N-A-N-A-R, was the moon god, sometimes called Sin. Nannar or Sin. So, Abram was not born in a primitive setting. He was born in a cultured, refined, artistic city that centered its worship in the worship of the moon. So, number one, we know he was born there. Now, for the second point, go to Joshua 24:2. Joshua 24:2. Joshua 24 and verse 2. Now, the question you'd naturally want to ask, or should come up in our minds, if Abram, who was the father of the children of Israel and knew the one true God, the question you would naturally have is, if he was born back in Ur, was he part of this? Did he worship idols? Was he part of the system that worshipped Nannar? Was he part of this? Well, we get some information in chapter 24, verse 2, that is going to say he was part of the religion of Ur. He was born in Ur, and he was part of its religion. Abraham was an old idolater. Or Abram, we should say. Chapter 24 and verse 2. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, from ancient times your fathers, and that again is identification enough, this would be Terah, the father of Abraham, Abraham himself, and so forth. Your fathers lived beyond the river, would point to the Euphrates River, namely Terah, the father of Abraham, and notice you've got two of them mentioned, Terah, Abraham, and Nahor. And they, speaking of all three, served other gods. And then he refers to, I took your father Abram from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and so forth. So notice the emphasis is that Abraham did not start out knowing God. He started out as part of the pagan religion of Ur. In other words, Abram was an urban dwelling idolater when God called him. And that is going to say basically two things. It's going to say in the first place that Abraham had nothing in his background to commend him to God. God didn't say, I'm going to make Abram my man because, hey, he's different down here in Ur. He doesn't worship Nannar. Not true. He was part of it. And it's also going to say that he was very much part of a system that knew nothing whatsoever about the true God. All right, number three. Back to Genesis 11. And we need this bit of information because it's going to be significant throughout his whole life. And notice the fact is dropped in as though you wonder, well, why do we need to know this? Well, we'll find it significant later because it's going to be one of the great pressures on Abraham. Notice chapter 11, verse 30. Sarah was barren. She had no child. So, therefore, we know that he married her there verse 29 makes that clear. Abraham and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarah. So, third point, he married Sarah here in Ur. And the extra fact, she could not have children. She could not have children. She was barren. That is going to focus then on the great pressure, or one of the great pressures placed on Abraham. And you would think if God was going to promise a man in his sovereign choice, going to promise a man that he's going to have a posterity like the sand of the sea, that you would at least pick a man whose wife could have children. I mean, that seems reasonable. I mean, you're going to really push on his credibility or ability to believe you to pick out a man of all men. Why don't you pick out somebody that had 14 kids already? At least that's a start, you know, in that direction. And if he's had lots of children, then the promise would be more credible, and it would be much easier to believe God in a context like that than it would in a context of picking out deliberately a man whose wife could not have children and promising him and taking him out by the seashore and saying, count the sand, that's how many kids you're going to have. And then on top of that, don't let him have any until he's so old that he can't have children, which seems about the wrong way to go about things. It seems like if God is going to promise to somebody, I'm going to give you $1 million, that it would be much easier to believe. If you already had $950,000, it would be much more credible, much more easy to believe. But God doesn't work that way. God's method of operation, inevitably, is to make a promise, and those promises seem so impossible that the only recourse is you're shoved in one of two directions, is to laugh at God and say, this is a big joke, or believe God in the face of all circumstances. And that's probably some of the setting for your 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight, which is what God demands. All right, fourth, we know that his call occurred in Ur. The call by God came in Ur. And we know and can subdivide under that call three things. The first one is found in Nehemiah 9, 7. Nehemiah 9, 7. Looking under the call of Abraham, which occurred in Ur. And the first feature is Nehemiah 9, 7. And the point we make there is it was a sovereign act of God. The call of Abraham, Nehemiah 9, 7, was a sovereign act of God. Now, by that, we simply mean this. It was not the idea that down in Ur, Abram began to get tired of his pagan religion, tired of his gods, and began to, quote, end quote, warm up to God. And God says, well, you are being nice toward me. I'm going to pick you as my man. Notice in 9:7, the emphasis is on the choice of God. It says, thou art the Lord God who chose Abram. And there's our first verb expressing the idea of choice on the part of God. You chose Abram and brought him out. Notice who's doing the work. You brought him out. And third, in Nehemiah 9:7, gave him the name of Abraham. Notice none of that is expressing what Abraham did. That is all focusing on what God did. God chose, God brought him out, God gave him. And the emphasis, therefore, down in Ur of Chaldees is how the choice and the call of Abraham was very much a sovereign act of God. And the emphasis is not that Abraham chose God and Abraham left his idolatry and he picked a name. The emphasis is that God chose, God brought, God gave throughout there. So Nehemiah 9:7 then focuses on the sovereign act of God. Or we could put it this way. Abraham did not discover God. God discovered Abraham. All right, now go to Isaiah 51. Isaiah 51, verses 1 and 2. This will focus on a second fact. And it's one we could easily ask and say, well, if God sovereignly chose Abram down in Ur of Chaldees, who else got picked? Who else came out with him? Or who was the other person that was taken out of the idolatry of Ur and brought into the relationship to God? And we can say it in as a second point, under the call coming in Ur, he was the only one chosen. Nobody else. Chapter 51 and verse 1 and 2. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug. The rock from which hewn and the quarry from which you were dug is going to be Abram down in Ur. Verse 2. Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who gave birth to you in pain. When he was one, I called him. Then I blessed and multiplied him. And notice the emphasis is when I called him, he was one, emphasizing the idea that he is the only one that God calls. So we were focusing then in our Old Testament period of time of God in his sovereign way reaching down into the pagan idolatry of a cultured urban city called Ur. And he said, I am going to pick out this man, Abraham, for a special and a unique purpose. So our point then, he is the only one chosen by God at that time. Second or third, when God called him, it involved minimum information. Hebrews 11, verse 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. It involved minimum information. Hebrews 11, 8. A little more light on what happened down in Ur. Now, what is the human response if someone walks up to you and says, hey, let's go? What's your response? I want information, especially if it's Saturday and the one suggesting some action is your wife. Don't give me this, hey, honey, will you promise to do something for me? I don't respond to that. I want to know what, because I know it's going to be. You know, it's clean the garage. It's been that for 15 years, clean the garage. We're going to do it some Saturday. And consequently, one of the key things, especially if you're unacquainted with a person, is if they want you to do something, please give me some information. Well, notice Abraham operated in the call of God with minimum information. Verse 8, by faith Abraham, when he was called, notice the juxtaposition in English of these words, when he called, obeyed. Isn't that simple? It's very simple. It's the hardest lesson in life. Simple response to God. When he called, obeyed, by going out to a place which he was to receive for inheritance. And catch this. And he went out, that's his obedience, not knowing where he was going. So here's a man situated in the urban life of Ur, and God says to him, go. And he was willing to act and operate on the minimum amount of information. Now that will move us then to the next phase or aspect of Abraham's life, which will be life at Haran, and let's cover that very quickly by saying two things. Life in Haran is Genesis chapter 11. He's now left Ur. And now in chapter 11, 31, 32, and point we'll make under the idea of Haran, coming down to verse 31, you got the departing group. You got Terah, Abraham and his wife Lot leaving. And therefore, you've got father, son, daughter-in-law, and grandson leaving. Their destination is obviously Canaan. But when you come down to verse 31, which reads as follows, Terah took Abram his son, Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went together from Ur of the Chaldees in order to enter Canaan. So it's clear where they're headed. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. Now, an obvious question, and we don't have a clear answer, but why? I think we can fairly say the destination was clearly Canaan, and yet they deviated and stopped at Haran. Now, I'm only going to give, and that's why I don't have much under the life in Haran, only a suggestion. We do know, again, this is from archaeology, that Haran, between Ur, which worshiped the moon god Nannar. And the destination of Canaan, we do know there was one other center for the worship of the moon god Nannar or Sin, and that was Haran. Now, that does not say that he relapsed. Did he? I don't know. You at least have a plausible explanation of why did they leave Ur to go to Canaan, leaving the gods that they had served all of their life, and why did they stop at that particular place along the way? Well, one possible explanation could be that there was a lapse at this point, and at any rate, the journey's broken, and we do have in verse 32, the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So he is going to be out of the picture and will be ready to come then too. The promise of God to Abraham, which is going to be the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, 1 through 3, and we'll look at about a half a dozen points under that next hour. Father, we're thankful for your word. We pray that we might learn to respond to you in the Abraham way, recognizing that like to Abraham, you have also given to us promises, and we are responsible to respond by faith. May we recognize that unless we learn from the life of Abraham the way he responded, then a possibility of a valid response to you is impossible. And therefore, may we give our attention to these very important chapters and concepts in Christ's name. Amen.